Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast, where editors of Managed Healthcare Executive chat with healthcare executives in the C-Suite and professionals. Our conversations are about the most important issues facing American healthcare today, such as its cost, effectiveness, delivery, organization, and its fairness. Listen in, learn a lot.
Hello, my name is Peter Werwein. I am Senior Editor at Managed Healthcare Executive. And today I have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Craig Samet. He's President and CEO of Minnesota Blue Cross Blue Shield. He's been in that position for a couple of years. And before that, he was at Anthem. We've met and talked before, so it's good to see a familiar face.
Good to see you, Peter. I hope you're well and you're safe.
Good. So you're in Minnesota, and I looked this morning, and I think you've had roughly 25,000 cases. About half have recovered.
And 2,500 cases.
2,500. Excuse me.
Yes, 2,500.
About half have recovered, and I think I saw about 160 deaths.
That is correct.
What has been the impact on Minnesota Blue Cross? How many COVID cases have you had? I think you have roughly 2 million members in Minnesota. So probably not that many, but.
Yeah, we represent about 40% of all of the insureds in Minnesota. And so while certainly we don't necessarily tally our membership against the Minnesota experience, you know, you can estimate that of the 2,500 or so cases that we've experienced, that in all likelihood, you know, in the ballpark of a 30 to 40% range would represent the impact that our membership has had. I think the impact for us has been, frankly, what it's been for everyone. This is a scary and a surreal and unprecedented time. And, you know, while Minnesota Blue Cross was the very first Blue plan in the nation, we've only been around for 87 or so years. And so the last major pandemic was before we existed. So this has been a new experience for all of us.
And I hate to, we're all grappling with this, but dollars and costs matter. Do you have any sense of how it's going to affect your expenditures? And I wonder particularly with the sort of shutting down of all routine medical care, elective procedures and diagnostic procedures and all that postponement, whether the effect on insurers is going to be rather mixed in terms of their expenditures, that you will see some costs associated with COVID, but with so much of healthcare sort of shutting down, whether it's actually going to be, you know, maybe offset.
Yeah. I mean, I think that right now, our current projections is that it won't be an offset, that actually we would experience, or at least we're projecting to experience a loss, a financial loss. And I think what you're likely getting at, and the best way to describe it is that we think that we're going to see some significant financial fluctuations over the course of the rest of the year. And frankly, that's the role that an insurance company plays, that that we are there to support the peaks and the valleys of healthcare coverage and care delivery that comes and goes through the course of a community's lifetime. So in the near term, you're right. We're seeing a deferral of elective procedures. We estimate that we've seen at least a 50% reduction in services that were previously provided prior to the crisis. And so in the immediate near term, we're certainly seeing a decline in services and obviously a decline in cost. The next wave we expect is going to be a significant surge in expense. Minnesota is not quite at its peak, and we don't envision that we may be at our peak for up to another 15 to 30 days. So we're expecting, as we've seen in other states, a significant rise in costs associated with testing, with treatment over the course of this, you know, the second phase of cost. I think the third phase is also going to be likely a savings phase, that immediately after the peak, I think we would expect to go back to a period where folks may be concerned about, you know, going back to the hospital or going back to physicians, even for elective procedures, just because we're fearful about a recurrence. So I think we're going to see a low utilization, a very high utilization that will far outstrip the low, and then another low utilization. And then the last phase will essentially be recovery, which is all of the pent-up demand, as we feel more comfortable, will now come back through the balance of the year. So when we look at it longitudinally, there's going to be valleys and there's going to be peaks. And at least our projection right now is net-net, it's going to be negative, not positive, in terms of utilization cost.
So I've seen a report, to think, out of California, Covered California, that we should anticipate significant premium hikes next year, because, you know, rates for this year were set, of course, before anybody anticipated this. How do you see it? Do you have any sense of whether you're going to need premium hikes next year to cover costs, or is it, as you say, that there's peaks and valleys and it's going to all kind of even out in the end?
Yeah. I think the first thing that I would say is I think it's likely too soon to tell. I know that many organizations are beginning to analyze pricing for next year, but there are so many variables and there's so many moving parts. I don't know if we can tell. I have some of my own beliefs about this. I think the reality is when the pandemic passes, which the large majority hopefully will be within 2020, when we now begin to think about 2021, will we see the cost of healthcare rise? I don't know if we would expect, you know, if we envision that there's going to be a new surge of cases, perhaps so, but if there isn't a recurrence of the pandemic in any way next year, then the question is would we expect utilization to be on par with what it was before the pandemic, or potentially even less, if we believe that we're going to utilize services differently in the future? And one of the things that I think will be very different, you know, we've been calling it the day after tomorrow. The day after tomorrow, we envision there are going to be many more services provided in the home or in the community or online.
Yeah.
I think there's still going to be some hesitance for us to just immediately say, I'm going to go to the emergency room, or I'm going to go to the hospital, or I'm going to go to the doctor with minor complaints. And so we could estimate that we may potentially see a lower utilization in 2021. And then the final thing that I would say is given the, you know, the economic depression, I don't think employers will be able to, and individuals will not be able to afford significant premium increases. And so I think we will all want to do what we can to suppress inflationary trends on pricing, because we just won't be able to sustain it and afford it as individuals or as a society going into the next year.
Yeah, you know, the combination of an economic downturn with a reshuffling of how healthcare is going to be delivered, it's, you know, you have sort of two huge variables there. I'm sure it's going to be hard to predict. Have you made any moves, even, you know, mid-pandemic, to accommodate the current surge to remote care and telehealth, but also to anticipate sort of healthcare delivery sort of profoundly changing, you know, after the peak passes and one hopes we settle into a new normal this summer.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been waiting. I've been at this for a long time now, and I've mostly spent my career in organizations that have wanted to fix healthcare and really transform the way we deliver care. And so I've been a fan of telehealth for decades now, and I've been waiting for telehealth to have its day, and that day is finally here. One of the very first things that we did was to open up telehealth immediately to our members through a partner who provides national telehealth. And we wanted to eliminate all barriers, both technologically as well as financially. So whether it was COVID-related symptoms or non-COVID-related symptoms, folks should stay at home. So we opened up that immediately. However, we also wanted to make sure that we helped our provider partners develop technology to see their own patients. So I think that's going to be the new world order. I think that will stay. I think we may be surprised. We're seeing many more patients as well as physicians embracing telehealth, which, you know, we could argue we haven't. We've been resistant up to this point.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have thought that it would be this type of shock to the system to really launch us into a reinvented future. But I think that reinvented future is now here, and I don't think there's going to be a going back. So I think that this is here to stay, and I think there are going to be many other things that are going to be different in the healthcare field in the future than they are today.
Just a couple of quick follow-ups on that. Who is your sort of national partner? And could you sketch out how you've helped, you know, providers sort of bring in telehealth or remote care into their own practices?
Sure.
And is it a question of, you know, helping them with the technology, or is it a question of setting payment policies so they're paid for the remote visit as much as they are paid for the in-person visit?
Sure. So the national partner with it we've historically worked with is Doctor on Demand. And so Doctor on Demand is the service that we've immediately provided to our members. But to answer your second question about direct patient-doctor relationship and preserving that, you know, the answer is yes to all of the above of what you've said. We obviously have to address the technological issues. And so for us, we've worked to assure that our provider partners have access to the technology they need, which is not quite as ubiquitous as we would think. So, you know, in terms of the computer technology, the camera technology, you know, even just easy access to Zoom-related services like these, how do we make sure that they're secure and they're safe? And so we've wanted to make sure that we can offer some resources and support for providers to connect. But we also realize that, you know, we should be paying for telehealth services at least in the near term comparably as we pay face-to-face services. If it's the same type of visit that a patient would have with their doctor face-to-face, and it's approximately the same amount of time for the physician that is working with the patient, why would reimbursements not be more comparable? So I think we're going to reevaluate everything, including payment policy. Obviously, there have been historical restrictions that have predominantly been CMS-based, but I think we all have had them, that we have to re-review these policies and change them so that, you know, that we can offer a much more convenient and in some cases equally high-quality service to patients through virtual means.
So did you change payment policies so, you know, during the last month or so? Because I think mid-March HHS CMS did change the regulations, and a lot of restrictions, and including I think some reimbursement policies, put the telehealth visit, and it didn't necessarily have to be through a portal, and it wasn't the virtual checkup, but, you know, just a regular visit was paid on par with the in-person visit. Did you make that move already, or is this something that you're working on?
No, we made that move already. We made that move early in the process. And I, you know, it's felt like the last month has been a year. So I don't know the exact timing of our decision versus CMS's loosening of the restrictions, but I'm quite confident that we went first in that regard and changed that approach so that we could ease access to telehealth services.
Good, good, good. Now, I think I read someplace that you also have advanced payments to providers. I think I saw a figure of $80 million or so. Are you doing first of all, is that figure correct? But also,
yes.
Are you doing anything else that to help providers who, you know, as we know, have seen their provision of service stop, and they've some providers have taken on the burden of COVID care, COVID-19.
Right.
But I'm just wondering how you're working with providers to get them through the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are numerous dimensions, I think, to the level of support that the providers need at this crucial time. One of the very early things that we did was to do our part to keep our provider partners safe. So we actually had an army of volunteers that were sewing handmade masks at a time when masks weren't available, or helping to identify how we could produce face shields. And so, you know, beyond just the financial support that you've already mentioned, and I'll come back to, what could we do given we knew that our provider partners were on the front line to really support them and keep them safe, which was a major concern. From a financial standpoint, you're right, the number's right. We've accelerated about $80 million in advance payments to providers in numerous different ways. You know, the accelerated payments are to network providers who have participated in various forms of value-based care and payment models so that we could accelerate those payments far into the present, as opposed to sort of after the fact, so that we helped with liquidity and cash flow issues. And not to mention just to really remove all the bureaucracy and the speed of claims payment so that there's no need for a claims hold. Let's pay the claims. So let's accelerate the payments so that at least what we could do would serve as a bridge to the stimulus dollars that were flowing to the providers from multiple states. And the last thing that I would say that we've done, which is not just near term, but it's longer term, is we have very much advocated for what we call a joint accountability model, which is that we need to have financial alignment between payers and providers that are accountable for better care at a lower cost. And the story that I would tell is I was at Dean Health System in Madison during the financial crisis in 2008. And Dean Health System was a partnership with SSM Healthcare and Dean Clinic. And I remember that many providers were struggling at that time as well, because in the economic downturn, people were similarly not wanting to come in for elective procedures. And what I remember is we actually were not struggling as much as most, because we were a population health company, not a volume-driven company. And so one of the things that we're looking at is, can't we much more rapidly accelerate paying providers totally differently on a population health perspective, so that whether there's peaks or valleys with services, the providers are stable through it all? And so those are the sorts of things that we're doing to keep our providers safe as best as we can.
That's interesting, because we've talked about utilization going down and your expenses and whatnot, but if you move to a population health model, those utilization issues will still be there, but they're sort of expressed differently, and they don't sort of carry with them so much of a financial aspect to them.
And so it actually aligns with what we talked about earlier, that, yeah, you know, we're going to be facing valleys and then peaks and then valleys. As an insurance company, that's the role that we play. But in a population health model, it's also now the systems that can buffer those peaks and valleys. companies. And that's the kind of model we're hoping to move to.
Well, I've talked to you a lot, or not a lot, but I've talked to you a couple of times about value-based care. And it also, I think, it's a little bit like telehealth. You know, people have talked about it for years. There's this model, there's that model, but it's the uptake is maybe uneven and halting. And so do you think that maybe the tomorrow after the tomorrow period after
the day after tomorrow,
after COVID, that maybe the COVID-19 crisis will sort of push population health along? Or I've wondered whether there's an alternate scenario where we're dealing with so much already, the economy is in deep trouble, and the last thing that we can take on is some sort of new payment thing. We just gotta hang on by the skin of our teeth here, and you know, the time for big fundamental change will have to wait till we're past the crisis. And therefore all these experiments and ideas that you and I have talked about a couple times over the years will just go on hold.
Well, I'm much more in favor of the former, not the latter. I'm biased, obviously, because I've been advocating for value-based transformation for a long time. But I think this will change us. I think the virus will change us. I think the way we live, the way we work, the way we care for patients, and the way that we pay for care is going to change. That's really my prediction. And I think the reality is, and I don't necessarily see this as the burden of a transformation of a payment model. I see this as a much more stable and secure payment model that really learns from the significant challenges that this crisis has exposed in our industry and offers a much more stable and consistent solution afterwards. So I certainly am going to continue to advocate with our provider partners in Minnesota to move in the former direction, which is to closer joint accountability for better care at a lower cost. And I'm hoping that we're successful.
Could you just unpack that a little bit? What about COVID, or perhaps the combination of COVID-19 and the economic downturn, would make people more open to value-based care, maybe some shared risk and the various arrangements that people have talked about? What about the situation would make people more open to this?
Well, I think that it's because the experience that we've had, especially as it relates to care delivery, and the exposure that we've had to a taste of a future model of care delivery, really aren't paid for or supported in a fee-for-service model. And so if we believe that in the future we would want to preserve the hospitals, the very precious hospital space that we have for, you know, ERs, ORs, and ICUs, and not as much of the deferrable or elective care, or if we believe that more people will want telephonic visits or telehealth visits or care at home, or if we believe that we're going to want to invest much more greatly, not just as clinical companies, but as social companies to address the social barriers. None of these things are reimbursed that way in a traditional volume-based model, but they are reimbursed in a value-based model. So I just think that why folks would embrace this is that it will allow us to redeploy resources in a changing system that we don't have the freedom to do in a volume-based model.
Right. Just a couple more questions. So, you know, an economic downturn, perhaps quite severe, seems in the offing. That would mean layoffs and people losing their employer-based insurance. So I guess I have a couple of questions. One, whether in Minnesota, because of the nature of the economy, whether there's some anticipation whether Minnesota might be affected less by an economic downturn. But more fundamentally, do you think that if we are headed for hard times, that this brings into question employer-based insurance? And do we have to look to public payers playing a larger role?
I think yes. If you're asking sort of what this crisis will potentially do in as it relates to concepts regarding Medicare for All or other ways that we can accelerate universal coverage, we've been long an advocate for universal coverage, mostly through a very effective patchwork quilt between public and private. And frankly, I think that patchwork quilt will still exist because there are many that will very much want and like and want to preserve their employer-based coverage. However, what we are gonna need to fix is the discontinuities in coverage, which have become readily apparent, although I think both the federal government and the states have reacted quickly to a short continuity. But I do think there will likely be stronger support for Medicare for All type programs coming out of the pandemic and the likely upcoming recession. And how and when it comes to the legislature will depend on sort of public demand, political leanings, the outcome of the November election.
Right.
But I do still believe that, few people understand how Medicare for All works and what the implications are. And public support shifts when they learn more.
Right.
The one thing that I would say that I've been advocating for, long before the crisis is this notion of a Medicare Advantage for more, can we create stability and coverage? What I like about Medicare Advantage is it Medicare, Medicare fee-for-service is just like we talked about, it's fee-for-service. It has challenges in a volume-based system. Medicare Advantage allows those degrees of flexibility and freedom to innovate. And so what I'm hoping we see is sort of greater support for kind of broader Medicare Advantage, which I think has this continuity of coverage with employer-based models, but also allows some of this value-based flexibility and freedoms.
And you have both the Medicare Advantage plan as well as, are you in the ACA marketplace?
Yes, for both. Medicare Advantage is relatively new in Minnesota. We've historically been predominantly Medicare cost, MedSup, and Medicare fee-for-service in the state. So Medicare Advantage is new, frankly, as of over the course of the last year or two. But yes, we're Medicare Advantage now as well.
Okay. And do you anticipate, I don't know how many lives you cover with your ACA marketplace plan, but how many do you cover now? And do you expect a big increase with furloughs and layoffs?
We would expect an increase. I think that we are expecting an increase in both Medicaid.
Yeah.
We expect that our enrollment will likely increase by as much as 25% as it relates to Medicaid. In terms of the individual and exchange marketplace, we would envision that we will also see a similar rise. The question is will that be temporary or will that be permanent? The same would be true of Medicaid, because it's still too early to tell what the impact of unemployment or underemployment will be in our marketplace. It's still a bit too soon, but we do expect that we will see a rise in public programs in the course of the next year.
Now, have you been talking to Minnesota State health officials, and in what way have you been working with government leaders in Minnesota?
Well, I mean, we've been working in any way and in every way that we can be supportive in this crisis. I think one of the things that we obviously can do best is to help support our members in terms of cost and coverage. So, you know, immediate coverage of the cost of treatment, the cost of testing with no out-of-pocket responsibilities is certainly one of the very early moves that we made to support the state or to support the providers through advanced payments, as we talked about, or PPE support. But I think that there are other ways that we're now talking about to provide additional support, especially as it relates to contact tracing or surveillance or testing. It's sort of the somewhat unknown but highly imperative next area of focus to bring back our livelihood and to have people feel safe and coming back out into the open, so to speak. And we've got an army of people who can kind of help in every respect. And so I think we're turning our attention to kind of what we're calling the tomorrow strategy, which is we've helped very effectively, I think, in the today strategy. Now, how do we help people come back out through the resources that we can offer or the people and the expertise that we can offer to think about recovery?
So are there going to be Minnesota Blue Cross, do you envision Minnesota Blue Cross, Blue Shield employees becoming part of the contact tracing effort? I mean, in a hands-on sort of a direct way or in some sort of supportive, maybe keeping, you know, the data?
You know, there have been, I think we're beginning to see examples of that in some other states with other Blue plans. And I think we very much want to be able to help in other ways. And if the state is amenable, and I certainly know that we would want to make our folks available if we can, I don't see why we couldn't help play a role. It feels like it would likely be an all hands on deck effort. And so it wouldn't just be us, but I would advocate for us to play a role along with others.
And in a direct way, or are you talking about the back office?
In a direct way, and even a direct meaning telephonic, likely, but direct and telephonic certainly could be one way that we could help.
Interesting. And those discussions are taking place with health officials or with other insurers, or, you know, is there a...
Well, right now the discussions are with other health insurers to really understand how we can more effectively play a role. And sort of this is just happening minute to minute. So my last discussion that I had about this was just 45 minutes ago. So this is a work in process, and we're hoping to talk to state officials yet next week if we can, to see how we can potentially help.
That's fascinating, and it does sort of remind me anyway that we are, you know, the current reality of COVID-19 is gonna shift into a different framework, a different reality in a few weeks' time. And so you sort of always have to be on the balls of your feet to anticipate what's gonna be needed next.
Very true.
So how are you doing personally? Have you been, I see your home, that looks like a home office.
This is not a virtual background. I'm doing fine, although I'm definitely an in-person guy. We've had town halls with all of our associates. I think I've spoken virtually to over 2,500 of our people in the last week. And I was asked, you know, are you having fun working from home? And I'm like, that fun is not the word. I'm definitely an in-person guy and miss the socialization. And I just think we've underestimated how difficult working from home is. I would imagine several of us were enthusiastic at first. You know, we've all got the hairy four-leggeds coworkers at our feet, and that's great. But I think we have to remember that beyond just keeping our people safe clinically and physically, we have to keep people safe behaviorally and socially. And so we've been doing everything for our associates. And frankly, I have to kind of follow my own advice when I talk to our people about taking breaks and realizing that when you're at home, there is no longer any beginning and end of your workday. So you can just become a total workaholic, and that's me by nature. It's worse at home. So I think we have to remember to take a break and take care of ourselves through this crisis.
Yeah. How late did you work last night?
You don't want to know. It was very late. It was a 4:30 a.m. start, and I didn't finish until midnight. So I can't keep that up. I'm hoping that it's a shorter day today.
Good. And maybe Saturday and Sunday, dial it back a little bit for your sake and for the people that you're working with and who are working for you.
I agree. Great to talk to you, Peter.
Thank you. Stay home and stay safe, and yes, we'll meet again sometime.
Same to you. Be well.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and follow Managed Healthcare Executive on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. For more information on Managed Healthcare Executive, visit our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.